This is the Bereishis series, and it's January 23rd. Okay, page 77. So we spoke about the names. Avram becomes Avraham. Sarai is revealed as Sarah. And the covenant that God is going to make with him, including circumcision. Now, verses 23 through 26 describes Abraham's performance of circumcision. There are lots and lots of very important and subtle details here. I just want to pick out one, which is a hint to something that's quite deep. 23 says, Avram took his son Yishmael and all the servants born in his household and all those that he purchased for money, all the male members of Avram's house, and he circumcised the flesh of the circumcision on the very day that God had spoken to him. This verse says, he circumcised them. Then it says, Abraham was 99 when he was circumcised on the flesh of his circumcision. Was circumcised is passive. Okay, we understand that he did it to himself. If he did it to himself, so you could say it active or passive. You could say he did it, and you could say it was done to him. It was done to him by himself. And his son, Yishmael, was 13 years old when he was circumcised in the flesh of his circumcision. Good. We understand in 25, Ishmael was circumcised because Abraham did it to him. Now it says, on that very day was Abraham circumcised with Ishmael, his son. And that's a little peculiar. Because in Abraham's case, he did it to himself. Whereas in Ishmael's case, he did it to Ishmael. So when it says Ishmael was circumcised, it means that Abraham did it to him. When it says that Abraham was circumcised, it doesn't mean that. It means he did it to himself. So it's not the same type of event. It's not the same type of action. Okay, you could say, you know, it's the same word that applies to two people in two different ways. It's not a kasha. It's not a disaster. Not a terrible contradiction, but it's a little peculiar. Then, if you push a little deeper, circumcision is not removing the foreskin. The famous Mishnah and the Dorim says, a person who says, I take a vow that I won't have any benefit from the circumcised, he means all Jews. From the uncircumcised, he means all non-Jews. And even if you have a Jew whose brothers died of circumcision because, let's say, they suffered from some kind of hemophilia, and then the rule is that if two have died, the third should not be circumcised. It's a danger to his life. And a Jew grows up with a foreskin. Still, when you say, I won't have any pleasure from the circumcised, it includes him with his foreskin. And if a non-Jew, as is done in some places, has the foreskin removed, the person says, I won't have any benefit from the uncircumcised, it's including a non-Jew without a foreskin. Circumcised is a title, and it doesn't refer necessarily to your anatomy. Uncircumcised is also a title. And that's certain spiritual connotations. the bris of Mila, the covenant, the circumcision, also is a spiritual transformation. The question arises, in spiritual terms, can a person really do this to himself? Can he do it to himself? Or must it be someone who applies it to him, someone who inducts him in, someone in a superior position, like an adult to a baby, where the adult has understanding and intention, and the baby has neither of those? Can it be done? Or must it be done by someone who is superior and pulls the person up into this new status? There's a medrash that says that Abraham was circumcised because as his hand held the knife, God's hand held the knife also. They held it together. And that was indicated by using the passive with respect to Abraham and using it in such a way that it's compared, the same verse, to Ishmael. Ishmael had no hand whatsoever in circumcising himself. If you say with Abraham it's a fully reflexive action, then Abraham and Ishmael stand as opposites to one another. Again, it's not a kasha. You could say that. Ishmael was entirely done by Avraham. Avraham could have been entirely done by himself, and the passive applies to both, each in an entirely different way, but the passive, strictly speaking, applies. You could have said that, but the Chazal want to push it more precisely and say that this is something that Avraham did for him. And that's what's going on when we circumcise our children, and when Abraham circumcised the rest of his household, he's carrying out the investment that God put in him by being engaged in circumcising him. Okay, that's just a hint. Okay, next page, 79. This is quite a complicated page. Next page as well. We're going to take it quite leisurely, not in any hurry. Let me read you through the story on this page, and then we'll go back and analyze it piece by piece. Hashem appeared to him in the plains of Mamre while he was sitting at the entrance of the tent in the heat of the day. Him is Abraham, of course. Although his name isn't mentioned here, but it comes out in the subsequent story, and from what happens before, we know that's Abraham. By the way, let me just mention something to you. We read a portion of the Torah every week, and we get used to that. In our minds, there are breaks. There's this parsha, and then that parsha, and then that parsha. That's totally artificial. In the text, there are no breaks at the end of a parsha. And very often, we think of a parsha as a unit, and we don't connect it with the previous parsha. That was last week, you know. Now I'm doing this week. And we have to be very alert and aware that these parsha breaks are artificial. They have nothing to do with explaining the text. Be very, very careful with that. Nothing to do. Well, Chazal made the breaks. They had something in mind. But the basic text, one has to read over the breaks to make sure that things are connected. Hashem appeared to him in the plains of Mamre when he was sitting at the entrance of the tent in the heat of the day. He lifted his eyes and saw. Behold, three men were standing over him. Well, in the Hebrew, it's alav. In English, we say standing over him. You think, I'm sitting on the ground, I look up, and there they are, you know, with their chins above my cranium. It doesn't mean that. It means across from him, opposite him. And they could be, as you'll see, some distance away. He perceived, he ran towards them from the entrance of the tent, bowed to the ground, and he said. Now, the next word in Hebrew is ambiguous. It can mean, as they translate here, my Lord, capital L, singular, referring to God, who was appearing to him, remember? So he's addressing God. Or it can mean my Lord's, little L, plural, the very same word, same pronunciation, in which case he's talking to the angels. And the commentators are split. Take it one each way. We'll see how that works. So he said, either my Lord, capital L, singular, or my Lord's, little L, plural, if I find favor in your eyes, please pass not away from your servant. Now, the paragraph break is totally artificial. There's no paragraph breaks in the Hebrew. Let some water be brought. Let some water be brought. Wash your feet and recline beneath the tree. In Hebrew, it says, I will take some bread. Not a morsel. I don't know whether the person writing here is from Scotland or from Arizona or whatever. In my vocabulary, a morsel is a crumb. You're not offering them a crumb. Pas lecha means a chunk of bread. Right? It's not cakes or whatever, but it's a chunk of bread that you may sustain yourselves. Now, the English writes fetch. Well, the English translator was in trouble here. The literal Hebrew word is I will take. Is he offering to take bread? Isn't he offering to give bread? Why would he say, I will take? We'll have a whole shot on that. So what does the translator do? He says, well, gosh, it's written I'll take, and it means I'll give. Fortunately, in English, there's a word that straddles the line. Fetch. What does fetch mean? Fetch means go and get and give over. So it doesn't mean get, take, but it means take and give over. The Hebrew doesn't mean that. Lakachat doesn't mean to take and give over. Lakachat means to take. So the translator artfully disguises the problem, and we'll have to face the problem directly. The Hebrew says take. That you may sustain yourselves, then go on, inasmuch as you have passed your servant's way. And they say, do so just as you have said. Again, there's no paragraph break. Abraham hastened to the tent, the Sarah, and said, hurry, 3 saws of meal, fine flour, knead and make cakes. Then Abraham ran to the cattle, took a calf tender and good, gave it to the youth who were to prepare it. He took cream and milk and the calf which he had prepared, and placed these before them, stood over them beneath the tree, and they ate. End of scene 1. There are lots and lots of problems here, and lots of pieces of analysis. First of all, globally, there are a lot of actions that take place on this page. All of them have as an adverbial qualification, the same adverbial qualification. How is every one of these actions done? With what adverb? Say again? Okay, I guess maybe people don't know what adverbs are. An adverb describes how an action is done.
Well, hastily.
Yeah, everything is done with speed. Watch. In 2, 3 men were said, perceived, so he ran toward them. Then 6, Abram hastened to the tent. Then 7, Abram ran to the cattle, gave it to the youth who hurried to prepare it. Even the youth is running over here. This is just an indication of a basic Jewish value. You have an opportunity to do a mitzvah, you don't let anything get in its way, and you do it as if it's very precious, a very precious opportunity, and you don't want to let it go by, and you want to bring it about as quickly as possible. Okay, now back to verse 1. There's a subtle problem here. Hashem appeared to him in the pains of Mamre. And then what? Does Hashem speak to him? Does Abraham respond to the appearance? All we have here is Hashem appeared to him. It has no continuation. It has no effect. Ain't davar kaze. There is such thing. In the Tanakh, when Hashem appears, it's for the sake of a purpose. It's supposed to accomplish something. Usually, when God appears, then there's a speech. Sometimes, when people are bent on an action, God's appearance stops them because they're overwhelmed with awe and they're paralyzed. Here, it just says, God appeared and that's it. Doesn't have any effect whatsoever. That's what motivates Chazal to say that he was appearing to Abraham on the 3rd day after the circumcision as one visits someone who's sick. They say that because in the style of this book, the literary style of this book, an appearance of God serves a purpose. We don't have dozens of places where God appeared, and then you go on with the weather and the war and so forth and so on. There's always an impact. Here alone, it doesn't have an impact. Now, where would they get the idea that this is the third day of the circumcision? I told you, it's on the previous page. Even though this is the beginning of a new parsha, but the previous page talks about circumcision. That's what immediately precedes this. So to say that he's visiting him in his pain because of the circumcision is very natural. It comes exactly after the fact that he performed circumcision. Correct, you wouldn't know what day it is. But we know from other sources that the third day is the worst. In fact, we know it from the Torah itself. In the case of Shechem, it says it came upon them on the third day when they were in pain. So from the very same book of Genesis, I know the third day of circumcision is the most difficult day. And I know that Abraham circumcised himself. And I know that God visited him. And I know that the purpose of the visit is not otherwise indicated in the text. Put two and two together, unlike the deconstructionists, you don't get 17, but you get 4. Right? It's a reasonable explanation. Okay, now, Hashem appeared to him in the plains of Mamre while he was sitting at the entrance of the tent in the heat of the day. Why do I care about that? I've told you a number of times, whenever you have details like this that are filled in a story, they're always for the sake of making the story understandable. Something in the story is enhanced or explained by putting in these details. What do I care whether he was sitting at the entrance of the tent, and what do I care whether it was the heat of the day? So you could say, he was sitting at the entrance of the tent, so he could see the passersby. If you sit in the interior of the tent, I don't know if you went with the group here to the Bedouins, but you know, the tents can be quite large. The tents can be, you know, I don't know, 40 feet on a side. They're very big. And you sit in the middle of the tent, you may not be able to see who's over the ridge. So the entrance of the tent, you can see the surrounding area, at least in one direction, very much more clearly. But then, if he's sitting at the edge of the tent to watch for a visitor, that's good. Why do I care at the heat of the day? Now, I'm told, though I don't have extensive experience with this, that in those Bedouin tents, the coolest part is the center of the tent. There's the tent heats up and it causes an updraft and because of the hot air, and then this air is drawn in from the sides, and you're in the center of where the shade is. So to say that Abraham is sitting at the edge of the tent means he's sitting in the hottest place. He's sitting in the hottest place on the third day of his circumcision when God's visiting him because he's sick. And why is he sitting at the edge of the tent? In order to look for passersby. This is a description of Abraham's commitment to hospitality, even under very adverse conditions. Built on those elements of the verse, Chazal explained the background to this incident as follows. It was a blazing hot day. Why was it a blazing hot day? Because God said, why should Abraham trouble himself on the day that he's sick to worry about passersby? I'll make the day so hot, no one will travel. And then he won't have that difficulty. Abraham's sitting there, and he's dying inside. Where are my guests? Where are my travelers? You know, to whom am I going to give hospitality? And God is helping him. He's making it so hot that nobody's coming. That's why God sends angels. He sends angels to be the travelers because there aren't any people who are traveling. And God, so to speak, says, if you want it so badly, so then, I'll give it to you. Okay? But that's all based on, or at least it's connected to, the idea that it's the heat of the day, and yet he's sitting at the entrance of the tent on the third day of the circumcision, when he's in pain, looking for travelers, which shows the commitment that he has to servicing travelers, and the fact that we know from the subsequent text that the travelers that came by were actually angels. So one has to motivate why God sent him the angels under those conditions. Yeah.
Does Rambam say that when it says he lifted his eyes, it means that this whole thing was a vision or a...
Okay, it's true. Maimonides says that all appearances of angels in the entire Tanakh are in dreams. It has nothing to do with raising his eyes. There are times when angels appear without raising eyes. And there are many times when raising eyes is used when you see people. You don't have to see angels. So it's one of the raising eyes isn't the issue. And that's a very controversial statement of the Rambam. Nachmanides criticizes him with bitterness, with real bitterness. You know, dirt to his mouth for having said such a thing. And he's really extremely critical of that statement. So I wouldn't take Maimonides' statement there as the Jewish view on the subject. But he does say it. It's true he does say
it. Rambam, with the M, is the one that's very logical?
Every last one of our sages is very logical. There is no difference in the level of logic from sage to sage. This is deep-seated university prejudice about these things, that we interpret what they say on the basis of our understanding of their personalities and their strengths and weaknesses, and it's totally incompetent. Totally incompetent and very injurious. It would be like someone saying, you know why Einstein thought of relativity? Because he grew up in Vienna. In Vienna, there were different cultures, and he bought pizza in this store, and he bought falafel in that store, and that's why he thought of relativity, because everything's relative. What would someone say? You're talking about the greatest scientist of the 20th century, Time Magazine's Man of the Century. And he did it because of pizza and falafel? Give me a break! That's just not credible. He did it because he understood all of physics up until his time. He knew it was a very deep problem, and he found the solution. Right? They say, well, he was logical, and he was a mystic, and he loved people, and he was very elitist, and that's why they did what they did. That's absolute baloney. It's absolute baloney. That one has to just outgrow that. What it does is cut them down to our size. I know that I have my subjective tendencies, so they have their subjective tendencies. I know that I have my prejudice, they have their prejudice. When it's just, you study what they wrote, you study what they accomplished, it's just awesome. It's awesome. I'm learning the Dorim now in Daf Yomi. Ron wrote a commentary. He didn't write this commentary. I'll tell you, I'm not like this on any other Masechta. Why he chose the Dorim, I don't know. But he explains every word and every move. And he explains alternatives. And he organizes the logic. And he analyzes the concepts. It's breathtaking. It's breathtaking. You know, I couldn't do that if I worked on it for 1,000 years. And some would say, well, the Ran was a Sephardi, and the Sephardim are very, very emotional. And therefore, give me a break. You're talking about an outstanding genius. If he says something, it's based on his genius and his encyclopedic grasp of the tradition, and not because he had falafel for dinner. Okay, back to work. So, he lifted his eyes and saw, which phrase does occur quite often, which indicates that typically the eyes of these people are not raised up. They have a downward gaze. Behold, three men. Now, here, the word in the Hebrew is men. In fact, they're not. They won't be men. In fact, they'll be angels. So, what we have to be describing here is how they looked to Abraham at the moment, because the subsequent story will make it quite clear that they're angels. We're standing opposite him. He perceived, now strictly speaking, this, he perceived, and by the way, in the Hebrew, it's the same as the saw at the beginning of the verse. It's the same verb. But of course, in English, if you repeat the verb, you know, it sounds awkward. That's why I say the same thing twice. So you change it to another word. It's the same in the Hebrew. Never mind. Not worried about that. Right? The translation has to be stylistically. What it means by repeating the same verb again, I don't know. I see that Rashi does not comment on it, and I don't know why it says it again. Maybe it isn't Rashi. I see in the English over here, the words repeated because two things happened. First time I saw them coming, then they stopped. It isn't perceived that the reason they did so was to indicate they did not wish to trouble him. All right. Right, so he saw two things. First he saw them traveling, then they saw him. And they knew what his intention was. So they stopped so as not to draw close to him and not to trouble him. And he ran anyway to greet them. Yeah.
What's the phrase standing over him?
Well, as I said, well, maybe it was before you came in, Over him is not correct. Over makes it sound like his chin is above your cranium, right? Obviously, there's some distance. He has to run to greet them. Al in Hebrew is a quite versatile word. It can mean on, like my hand is on the table. It can mean above, like now my hand is above the table. And it can mean across from. We talk about various tribes encamped on the tabernacle. They weren't sitting on top of the tabernacle. They're across from the tabernacle in a particular direction. So here the al means across from, opposite him, from a distance. Anyway, he ran toward them from the entrance of the tent and bowed to the ground. And he said, now, there are two possibilities here. One is, like your translator says, it's my Lord, singular, capital L, and Abraham is facing a dilemma. God is appearing to him. And he's running to do hospitality to these guests. What should he do about God? He's turn his back and just, run into the distance. So first he addresses God who's appearing to him. My Lord, if I find favor in your eyes, please pass not away from your servant. That's addressed to God. And by the way, the verb there is singular, so that fits quite well. Asking God's vision not to desert him. Then he turns to the travelers. That's why your English translator put a paragraph break, even though in Hebrew there's no paragraph break. And now he says to them, let some water be brought, wash your feet, recline in the dinner, fetch a morsel of bread, sustain yourselves. Here the verbs are all plural. And that, all the pronouns, they're all plural. So that fits quite nicely. That's one way to do it. Yeah.
Let's bow toward the ground. Why would you do that?
Oh, yes. This is very important. He bowed toward the ground. You have to know, prostrating oneself on the ground is a polite greeting. It's not worship. It's just a polite greeting. Proof. When this week's parsha, when Yisro, Moses' father-in-law, comes to visit him in the desert, Moses goes out to greet him and prostrates to the ground in front of his father-in-law. Moses is not worshiping his father-in-law. Prostration is just a polite form of greeting. In Megillas Esther, when Mordechai does not prostrate himself to Haman, Haman goes ballistic. Right? Because if you look at the commentary of the Malbim there, it's a gross insult. That's the way you're supposed to greet a high official. That's why King made a decree that everyone should prostrate themselves when he comes by. It's a way of showing him respect.
When he prostrates himself here, then right away he addresses God.
Okay, that's one of the reasons why you have the other translation. Right? The other translation is, my Lord, little L, plural, my lords, talking to them. And the whole speech is only talking to them. Okay? Now, if it's taken that way, he's asking them not to pass away from him, but rather to stay. I pass not away from your servant is singular. So it's addressed, they say, to the leader of the three. One of them was designated leader of the three. First he says, my lords, all of you. Then he addresses the leader. Here's what I want. Don't pass away from your servant. And then he says, the result, this is what I'll do for all three of you. So now, I'm trying to remember how the question went. So a child in my son's school asked a beautiful question here. I can't remember how it goes. But at any rate, I remember the answer, but I don't remember the question. So you could ask, well, which one is it? Is it capital L singular, where he's talking to God, or is it little L plural, where he's talking to the three of them? And the fact that the text is written in an ambiguous way may indicate that both are true. Both are true. When you have an ambiguity in a text, it could be interpreted A or it could be interpreted B. Resist the temptation to ask, well, which one is right? Think rather, Maybe they're both true. Maybe the author of the text wrote it ambiguously in order to communicate simultaneously both meanings. What would you do if you're reading a sonnet by Shakespeare? And you realize that a certain section could be read in one of two ways. Would you say, I wonder which one Shakespeare had in mind and which one he missed and got in there by accident and he didn't really intend it? Is that what you would say about Shakespeare? I don't think so. You would say, if the text can reasonably interpret it in two ways, Shakespeare surely knew that. I didn't discover something that Shakespeare didn't think of. Of course, with today's chutzpah and unseemly pride, maybe you could think you discovered something that Shakespeare didn't think of. After all, Shakespeare was so dumb, he lived 400 years ago. His works have lived for 400 years and will live for another 1,000 years. So what? I can be smarter than Shakespeare. But if you're a little reasonable, which is maybe 10% of the time, you think Shakespeare was a revolving genius and he wrote some of the world's greatest literature. Probably he knew both meanings. And he put them in there on purpose. And then you ask, why did he write it ambiguously that it could have both meanings? What did the two meanings contribute to the overall development of the sonnet? That's what you would do. I'm recommending, in general, there may be exceptions, but in general, that's the attitude you should take towards ambiguity in a biblical passage, that both meanings are intended, and that's why it's written in a way that's ambiguous. Okay, they say, do as you've said. Abraham hastened to the tent, the sword, he said, hurry, 3 swaths of meal, fine flour, need to make cakes. Then he went to the cattle, calf tender and good, gave it to the youth, prepared it, cream and milk of the calf. Now let's see, what did he promise them in 5? A chunk of bread. Sounds like they're getting a much more elaborate meal than a chunk of bread. And here, the rabbinic tradition derives the principle that when you deal with people, say little and do much. Give more than you promise.
Maybe the bread went between the milk and the meat.
Well, we'll see. Now, okay, let's address this. Let's address this. What about the milk and meat? Oh, my goodness gracious. Abraham, the patriarch, the founder of the whole religion, he's serving milk and meat. How could you think of such a thing? Boys and girls, if you take 3 minutes to think about it, you'll see that there's no question here at all. It doesn't start, it doesn't get an inch off the ground. Number one, who is forbidden to eat milk and meat?
Humans. Yes.
Even Chinese?
Well, I mean, these guys are angels, so they can't.
But, really, well, we'll have to ask, we have to ask whether he knows that or not, but we said they appeared as people, right? But it's only Jews that are not supposed to eat milk and meat. They're not Jews. They're not being treated as Jews. They haven't pledged allegiance. Why shouldn't he serve milk and meat to non-Jews? Number one. Number two, the biblical prohibition of eating milk and meat is only when they are cooked together. Only when they're cooked together. There's no indication here that he cooked them together. Secondly, in separating milk and meat, so in which direction must you wait between milk and meat? When you first have meat and milk afterwards. But here it says he gave the milk and then the meat. Right? So there's not even a necessity for separation. Okay, some say wait a half hour, rinse out your mouth. You don't know that didn't happen. But worse than that, everything's being done with the utmost haste. Now let's think. How long does it take to prepare and serve milk? 10 minutes. Milk the cow and put it out in front of them. How long does it take to prepare and serve butter? Half hour. How long does it take to prepare a live calf? We have to slaughter it and skin it and butcher it and cook it, right? That's a couple of hours. Are you going to tell me that he let them sit there under the tree with nothing, waiting for the end of the preparation of the meat? Of course not. He gave them everything that he could as quickly as possible. So he gave them the milk in 10 minutes. He gave them the butter in a half hour. And an hour and a half later, he gave them the meat. There's absolutely no reason to think here that there's any mixture of milk and meat. The appearance to the contrary is a fruit of simply not reading. Yeah.
Is there any thought that a lot of people say if you have bread, that's enough to constitute having a meal? So when he said that he'll fetch them bread,
No. When it's said that if you have enough bread, it constitutes a full meal. What it means is, if you have enough bread, then you have to bench afterwards. You have to have, and if you have a certain amount of cake, you also have to bench afterwards. But it doesn't mean there's anything else. If you just have bread, you have to bench. So it doesn't indicate that the other things were accompanying it. And the word meal can refer to having bread alone. Doesn't imply that you have other things accompanying it. Yeah.
Are things in the Chumash supposed to be like extra? Like, is it a problem if something is extra? Which is
absolutely. If something is extra, then we don't understand it. It's come to teach us something we didn't get. Why?
So it says he perceived, so he ran toward them from the entrance of the tent. Where else would he run toward them?
Good for you. I don't know, but you're absolutely right. I thought of it as we went through. Why does he say he ran from the entrance of the tent? That's where he was. Let me just check if Rashi says anything on it, but I don't think so. But that's the right question to ask. Why bother telling me he ran from the entrance of the tent? I don't know. Okay, now, our oldest son pointed something out to me here, and it's quite subtle. What does Abraham say to them? Sit under the tree, I'll bring you a meal, and then pass on. As some of you know, after the incident with Abraham, two out of the three angels come to Sodom. And Lot gives them hospitality. Just glance at page 85. And let's see how Lot gives hospitality. The two angels came to Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting at the gate of Sodom. Lot stood up and met them, and he bowed the face to the ground. He said, "Behold now, my lords, turn about, please, to your servant's house. Spend the night, wash your feet, wake up early, and go on your way." And they said, "No, rather, we'll spend the night in the square." And he urged them very much. So they turned toward him, and they came to his house. He made a feast. And here the word in Hebrew is a drinking feast, a mishta. Okay, you don't drink without eating. It's not healthy. It's not even enjoyable. But it's made on the drinking. It's a drinking party with food, because you can't drink, and baked the matzahs, and they ate. So my son pointed out, Abraham entertains them under the tree, outside the house. Lot invites them into the house. Abraham gives them food. Lot makes for them a drinking party and invites them to stay overnight. Right? Shall we say that Lot's hospitality was superior to Abraham's? Not very likely. Not very likely.
It's a very hot day.
So it seems like, we said the coolest place was in the tent, right? The coolest place in the middle. Sure, that's why I have a tent. People don't sit outside on a hot day.
Yeah, but wouldn't it be under the tree? Or wouldn't that be, because then there would be wind inside the tent that would block all the wind?
No, you'll go to the Bedouin tents. The tent is like 3 feet off the ground. It doesn't go down to the ground. And you have a draft, and it has a high center part. Right, and there's like a drift that goes up. They're made to provide that. So what my son said was, what we're learning here is that hospitality should have limits. These are idol worshippers. So you serve them, but you also keep a distance. You don't make a drinking party. At a drinking party, you're going to be lightheaded, and you're going to be convivial, and you're going to come to have much too close a relationship. In Abraham's case, he doesn't even sit down. He's not part of their feast. He stands and he's attending them, so that he's serving them and they're eating, but he's not eating with them. Right? There's a sense of distance which is integral to appropriate measure of hospitality. Yeah.
Abraham also served meat.
Yes. I don't know what we're doing with the word suda here.
In terms of
honoring them.
Yes,
he took a fresh calf and slaughtered it. It's a big expense. That's quite right. We don't know what food Lot suggested to have at the meal. But we know the word he used was mishteh. Abraham doesn't use that word. As you know, as a Hebrew speaker, mishteh comes from lishtot. So it's based on drinking. It's not, the food is incidental. Okay, now back to 79. I want to teach you one philosophical idea here. Did Abraham know there were angels or not? The commentators are split. There's one clear indication that he didn't know. What indication is that? Okay, that's good. He made them wash their feet. Why did they make them wash their feet? If you say that they were washing their feet to wash off dust, which is one of the things that that people worshipped in those days, if you knew they were angels, he shouldn't have done that. Also, say again, it fed them. Angels don't eat, right? That's on the side of those who say he didn't know they were angels. But there is another point of view, that he did know they were angels. If he did know they're angels, why in heaven's name would he serve them a meal and wash their feet? I think this, maybe it's my prejudice because I'm a philosopher, but I think there's a really important philosophical idea here. Imagine the following example. You're a member of the Secret Service assigned to the President of the United States. You happen to be off duty one evening in downtown Washington, and you know that George W. Bush, from time to time, likes to hear what ordinary people say. So he disguises himself as a bus driver with a battered old jacket and a slouched cap and goes strolling in the streets of downtown Washington to talk to people and hear what they say. And you're off duty, and in front of you, down the street, you see a bus driver with a beat-up jacket and a slouched old hat, and there's that body language, the lift of the left elbow and the tilt of the head. You say, I'll bet. So you walk around and you look at the front. You say, ah, oh, that's him. The Prez, you know, Mr. President. Would you go up to Bush at that moment and say, good evening, Mr. President? After all, you know he's the president. But no, that would be very dumb because he's trying to look like a bus driver. That means he wants to be treated as a bus driver, even though you know who he is. Abraham says to himself, these angels are visiting me, but God sends them to me looking like men. Why would he do that? He's sending them to me looking like men because he wants me to treat them like men. Now, the philosophical idea here is this. We have a fixed idea in our mind to contrast appearance and reality. And we discard the appearance. We say, don't be taken in by appearances. It only looks that way. That's the way it really is. So for us, appearances are the throwaway. They're the thing you shouldn't pay attention to. Get past the appearances and look at the reality. But the truth is that the appearances are also a reality. They're just a different kind of reality. There is what X is in and of itself. That's one reality. And there's another reality, how X appears, which is also a reality, only it's X's relationship to me, not what it is in and of itself. I'll prove it to you. You take a half full glass of water and you put a knife in. So you know that from most angles, when you look at the surface, it looks like the knife is bent. Now imagine you're looking at this half full glass of water with a knife in it, and you see that the knife looks bent. Somebody stands right next to you, looks at the glass, he says, I don't understand what you mean. The knife looks perfectly straight. He has a problem with his eyes, with his optic nerve, with his brain, or with his mouth, right? Because it really looks bent. Notice the vocabulary. It really does look bent. And if he doesn't see that, he's got a problem because that's the way it really looks. So there's a difference between the way it really is and the way it really looks. Both are real. Now the Torah is teaching us, among many, many other things, that the reality of how a thing looks is an important reality, not to be discarded, not to be simply overlooked. And then this opens up a whole dimension of thought and analysis. Are we the center of the universe? Well, yes and no. Copernicus, Einstein, relativity. But one thing's for sure, we definitely look as if we're the center of the universe. don't know how many of you read the New York Times. You know, I hope you don't. But like in most newspapers, it prints every day the time of sunrise and sunset. Now, gentlemen, sunrise and sunset? Does the sun really rise and set? Gosh, and the New York Times back in the Middle Ages, better off they were. They really think the sun goes up and down? Everybody knows the sun doesn't go up and down. It's only the earth rotating. Yeah, but it looks that way. And that's why we still talk about sunrise and sunset. You watch a sunset sometime and try to think to yourself, the sun's not moving at all. I'm just rotating backwards. I'm moving backwards away from the sun. Try it. The sun's going down. You can see it, it's going down. Right? So we would have to reflect not only what I learned from astronomy, which is fine, you know, and may very well be accurate, but also it doesn't look that way. It looks as if we're at the center. And that has to teach us something as well. Appearances are just another form of reality. An appearance is a relational reality. And it is as much a reality as the reality that isn't relational and has its own effect. You see here, according to those who say, Abraham knew that they were angels, he treated them as people because they looked like people.